Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Today we've got discussions on reclassifying lakes, redetermining our voting districts, what it's been like having Burlington High School relocated to a downtown mall, and we'll reach far into the future as we get ready for this weekend's Vermont Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo. Let's start by discussing the reclassification of the state's highest quality bodies of water. It's a situation where good just isn't good enough. Here to explain what's happening and why is Oliver Pearson, Lakes and Ponds Program Manager for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Oliver, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Morning, Rick. Great to be here.
Morning. Well, listeners, if you've got a question for Oliver about the reclassification of our lakes, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. First of all, Oliver, explain what, and I might need help with the pronunciation of this, an oligotrophic lake is.
Sure, happy to. Your pronunciation was very good. We say oligotrophic. Oligotrophic is basically a lake with low biological productivity, low nutrients. Often it has very clear water and less plant growth than, say, a high-nutrient lake, you know, like parts of Lake Champlain. So we're lucky to have a range of lake types in Vermont, but we have a good number of these low-nutrient or oligotrophic lakes, particularly in the Northeast Kingdom and other parts of the states as well. And these are really jewels, you know, some of the lakes that folks think about when they think about our beautiful vistas in Vermont, like Lake Willoughby or Maidstone, are considered oligotrophic lakes. And I'll stop there, but we have some concerns about water quality trends with those lakes, which I can speak about as we move forward.
Why do they tend to be cleaner and lower in nutrients?
Well, historically, there's not a lot of activity in these lake watersheds. These are often forested watersheds without a lot of different types of land use that can lead to water quality degradation. And then, you know, going back further in time, you know, some of these lakes are glacial lakes, and both the way that the lakes were created and the current soil types in the lake watershed, you know, don't lead to a lot of nutrients flowing into these lakes. And therefore, you know, the plant growth and algae that we see in some sort of middle or high nutrient lakes isn't sort of a common symptom, if you will, of these low nutrient lakes. So it's a combination of how they were created, sort of the geologic and land conditions around them, and then the land use patterns over the last 100 years or so have led to, you know, many oligotrophic lakes that we have in the state.
What has been happening in these lakes regarding their overall health that has you somewhat concerned?
Great question. So what we're seeing is, you know, we have scientists that monitor water quality trends in these lakes, you know, and going back to the 1970s. And what we're seeing in almost all of our low-nutrient or oligotrophic lakes in the state of Vermont is increasing nutrient trends. So we measure phosphorus, because that's the limiting nutrient for plant growth in Vermont's lakes. And we're seeing, you know, increasing values, as I said, in almost all oligotrophic lakes. Some of them are increasing quite quickly. And that increase will lead to changes in lake water quality, in plants. And, you know, most of those changes are not things that Vermonters, you know, would be too happy about. A lot more plant growth. In some cases, that can lead to algae blooms, the type of that we see on lakes like Mimfermagog and Karma and Champlain. It can lead to less ideal conditions for aquatic wildlife, including fish. Some of our really high phosphorus lakes have related conditions involving low oxygen, for example, that can lead to fish kills. So it's a trend that we're concerned about because most often this trend of increasing phosphorus is associated with deteriorating water quality conditions. And we're really trying to avoid that and maintain these lakes in their current excellent conditions.
Have we taken our eye off these bodies of water because of the problems with some of the other lakes you mentioned, like Champlain, Carmi, Memphremagog, you know, who really have needed more attention lately?
I think it's definitely fair to say that the majority of the funding and the projects aimed at improving water quality are in the, you know, the watersheds of those three principal lakes, you know, Carmi, Memphremagog, and Champlain. And they have these, you know, EPA mandated lake restoration plans or phosphorus reduction plans. Folks may have heard the term TMDL, or total maximum daily load, which is our plan to reduce phosphorus loading into these lakes. But I don't think we've taken our eye off these, you know, inland lakes. I think we've been monitoring them for quite some time. I think we've only really in the last maybe 5 years become aware that these trends are widespread across the state, that they're increasing in a statistically significant manner, which is sort of always the sign that, oh boy, there's a trend here we need to be worried about. And then we've begun to think about ways to increase protections for these lakes while also simultaneously, you know, identifying what are the stressors in the lake watershed that's leading to these increases in phosphorus. And what can we do to address those? And, you know, Vermont's lucky to have the Clean Water Initiative program that makes funding available for clean water projects. We have some federal money coming in to support those projects as well, both inside the Champlain Basin and in other parts of the state. Some of these high-quality lakes are in the Champlain Basin, like Caspian Lake in Greensboro, for example. So it's a relatively recent issue, and we're beginning to focus on it more acutely. But you make a really good point. I mean, it's the restoration of these large lakes like Champlain and Memphremagog is extremely important, and we'll continue to work on that. But, you know, this is sort of a prevention effort. You know, if we tackle the increasing phosphorus in these inland lakes that are still low nutrient or oligotrophic earlier, it'll cost less and have a greater chance of success to kind of maintain them at their current high quality or excellent state. So we're trying to both restore our impaired or damaged waters, mm-hmm. also maintain our high-quality waters.
What efforts have been undertaken to maintain the health of these high-quality waters?
Yeah, it varies from lake watershed to lake watershed. But, you know, we work with the Department of Environmental Conservation, uses Clean Water Initiative Program funding to implement projects that will really reduce nutrient and sediment runoff into the lakes from a variety of sources. So that can be anything from road upgrades, municipal or town roads or even state roads around the lake to reduce erosion and stormwater runoff. It can be working with shoreland property owners to either make their properties more lake-friendly, reduce stormwater runoff, or even reduce impervious surfaces, get more vegetation in, and restore some of the natural filtration that vegetation around the shoreline can provide, because that's a really important zone to reduce pollution into the lake. You know, and it's working with our agricultural partners and logging partners to support the implementation of required agricultural practices or logging accepted management practices, so that, you know, stormwater runoff and just, you know, the general contribution of those activities to nutrient pollution in our lakes is reduced. So there's a good deal of funding that goes out on an annual basis to support projects in different lake watersheds across the state. And then we track those and we see, you know, are we seeing decreases as a result of these projects in the streams or tributaries that are flowing into the lakes, decreases in nutrient concentration, and are we seeing any improvements in lake water quality as a result? So Seymour Lake in Morgan, Vermont is a great example where 10 years ago we had increasing total phosphorus trends coming into that lake, but because of the hard work of the lake community, you know, the Seymour Lake Association and people that lived in that area, we were able to implement some projects and reverse those trends. And now the nutrient levels in Seymour Lake are stable, which is good. But that Seymour Lake is a success story. We have many other future, you know, lakes that still haven't achieved that type of success, and those are the ones that we're concerned about. So Caspian Lake in Greensboro, Lake Willoughby in Westmore, Maidstone Lake up in Maidstone, Shadow Lake in Glover. Those are examples of lakes that all have these significantly increasing total phosphorus concentrations, which could lead to water quality deterioration. So those are some of the lakes that we're targeting, both for activities in the watershed as well as, you know, increased protections to maintain these excellent waters, you know, now instead of waiting 10 or 20 years before things get even worse.
I want to talk about this idea of classifications. How are our lakes classified?
Yeah, so the Clean Water Act, federal law, statute, and then the Vermont Water Quality Standards, you know, requires us to classify lakes. And so sort of out of the gate, that the general point of departure for classification of surface waters, you know, fresh waters in Vermont, is they all have to be classified as good. And the term in the Vermont Water Quality Standards for good is also known as B2. And that's the minimum standard we have to maintain. Otherwise, a water body is considered impaired, and then we have to work to restore it. And so Champlain, for example, does not meet the good requirements or the B2 requirements under the Vermont Water Quality Standards, and that's why we have this total maximum daily load, you know, phosphorus reduction plan for Champlain. And that's why we're investing millions of dollars a year to reduce nutrient pollution and surface water runoff, both from point and non-point sources in Champlain's watershed, and hoping to improve water quality in the lake. And that should lead to, you know, improvements in water clarity, some reductions in algae, et cetera. So, and again, to get back to your question, all lakes are at a minimum classified as B2. What the Vermont Water Quality Standards has done is has allowed us to use nutrient criteria to define thresholds for lakes to be classified as very good and excellent. And so, you know, I'll sort of geek out here for a second, but if for a lake to be very good, it has to have a concentration of total phosphorus of 18 parts per billion or less. You know, and right now parts of Champlain are in the 20s. So, you know, Champlain is obviously above that 18 parts per billion concentration. And for a lake to be classified as excellent, it has to have a concentration of 12 parts per billion or less of total phosphorus. And we have plenty of lakes that are below 12, and these are these oligotrophic, low-nutrient, very clear lakes. So those lakes meet our numeric nutrient criteria to be put into that excellent category. But that is an extra step that we have to take to do that. We've done that for a few lakes already in Vermont. You know, many years ago, the legislature classified all lakes above 2,500 feet as excellent or A1, and you know, that was a good decision. Those lakes are generally in undeveloped watersheds. The water quality is excellent. Most of those lakes, if not all, are considered oligotrophic lakes. And then in 2016, a number of lakes in the Green Mountain National Forest in wilderness areas were also reclassified to A1. So we do have some excellent classified lakes already in Vermont, but those are all in really watersheds that aren't places where people live and work. And so what we're seeing is, boy, in these lakes where people live and work, that have camps, that have year-round homes, that have businesses, we still have excellent water quality, but it's beginning to deteriorate. So we want to work with those lake communities, lake associations, the town select boards, other stakeholders locally, to explain, you know, what's going on with their lakes, and then if there's local interest to increase protections and maintain that excellent water quality, we can then begin this process of reclassification.
So what is the point of upgrading these bodies of water from good or very good to excellent?
Sure. I mean, the basic there's a couple of basic benefits of reclassifying a lake to A1 status. First, already on the books in Vermont are a number of statutory, you know, management prohibitions for an A1 watershed. And so if you reclassify a lake to A1, that also applies to the waters upstream in that lake's watershed, you know, which for a small lake can be hundreds of acres, for a large lake can be thousands of acres. So if you do bump a lake up to A1, there's a few laws on the books. For example, any new septic systems, you know, indirect discharge or septic systems need to have a design flow of 1,000 gallons per day or less. And so 1,000 gallons per day is a pretty large septic system. We usually say that a house can have up to 12 bedrooms and get away with less than 1,000 gallons per day design flow. So maybe a very large house with 13 bedrooms wouldn't be able to be constructed in an A1 watershed if it needed a 1,000 gallon per day or greater septic system. But I don't think there's too many of those in Vermont. But, you know, a new business, you know, be it a large restaurant, a campground, hospitality facility, would have to think about that. So that's one of the restrictions in an A1 watershed. There's some other restrictions around direct discharge of waste into water bodies in A1 watershed as well. That, you know, I think most people would probably be supportive of. You know, for example, you can't have a solid waste management facility that applies biosolids or septage in an A1 watershed. So that's the first benefit of upgrading to A1 classification, is there's additional water quality protections. And those restrictions were put in place by the legislature to recognize that, you know, this is an excellent water quality lake or river, as the case may be, and we want to protect it. And therefore, you know, these solid waste management facilities or large indirect discharge systems are inappropriate to maintain that excellent water quality. You know, second, in an A1 water, you have this lower threshold for restoration action. So, as I said earlier, if you bump a lake up to A1, then it has to meet 12 parts per billion of phosphorus at its annual phosphorus concentration in the lake. Were it to exceed that, you know, where it's for 1 year, a couple of years, get up to 12.5 or 13, you know, because of these increasing trends we're seeing, then it would become impaired for A1, and this is under the Vermont Water Quality Standards and Clean Water Act, and then we'd have to go in and restore that lake to its A1 status. So it's really this mechanism for restorative action sooner that's really important. Rather than waiting for a lake like Willoughby to get all the way up to 18 parts per billion, which is the threshold for restoration and impairment as a good or B2 water, which could take, you know, fortunately that would take a long time at Willoughby, but if you wait that long, it gets harder and more costly to restore it. It would lower the threshold for restorative action to 12. And if the lake were to exceed 12, at that point, we'd have to come in and say, okay, it's considered impaired as an excellent water. It's no longer excellent. We need to restore it to excellent. And that kicks in place a sort of a state-led process to restore that water body, similar to what we're doing today for Champlain, Memphremagog, Carmi, et cetera.
Gotcha.
So that mechanism for action sooner is really important. You know, and then finally, one of the things I've observed is, as we discussed, our lake restoration efforts, Carmi, Memphremagog, et cetera, they get the lion's share of the funding for water quality improvement in lakes. And so logic suggests that if a lake is listed as A1 and then becomes impaired for A1, it too would have possibly access to funding for lake restoration projects, water quality improvement projects as well. And so when we're discussing reclassification with, you know, lake communities, you know, we'll say one of the potential benefits of this is when your lake and your lake watershed is competing for clean water funding against, you know, water bodies across the whole rest of the state, you know, because these funds are finite and so we have to choose where to spend them. The fact that you're an A1 water body, you're unique, you're listed as excellent, will likely increase the chances of receiving funding for some of the voluntary water quality improvement projects you want to do in the lake, either to keep it below that A1 threshold or if it ever does become impaired for A1, to then restore it to A1 status. So it might improve the chances for funding for clean water projects in that lake's watershed. So those, to me, are the three principal benefits of reclassifying.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. Let's try to get Stephen in here from Montpelier. Stephen, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how the lake reclassification process relates to the basin plans that are periodically revised.
Oliver?
Yeah, that's a great question, Stephen. So in the basin plans, the plans include a section about priorities for management and priorities for protection. And so if you read some of the more recent tactical basin plans that DEC has put out, those plans identify, you know, what we think are the most high-quality waters within that basin that should be reclassified or could be reclassified to either A1 excellent or B1 very good status. And so that the inclusion of reclassification in that plan sort of opens the door to the kind of work we're doing to then actually pursue reclassification for a given water body. So there is a link. Some of the older tactical basin plans don't have kind of some of our emerging priorities for reclassification yet, but those plans are updated every 5 years. And when they are updated, they'll include those priorities for protection And that kind of validates, in my opinion, you know, this reclassification effort if it's included in the basin plan, because that plan is signed by the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resource. It goes through a public comment process. And so if we get it in there, then we're being very clear and transparent with the public that this given water body is a priority for increased protection through reclassification.
And Oliver, are there any lakes currently in the process of reclassification?
Yeah, there are. I'm pleased that we've had some really dynamic and motivated, volunteers, members of lake associations, and also support from some select boards at town. So we currently have three petitions we've all received in the last month or so, for lake reclassification to A1 status. So Maidstone Lake up in Maidstone came in first, and that was, a kind of joint effort of the lake association and the town of Maidstone. Echo Lake in Charleston came in, and that petition was submitted by, the Echo Lake Protective Association. And third, just last week, we received a petition from Caspian Lake. That was a consortium of actors, including the town of Greensboro, the stewards of Greensboro Watershed, the Greensboro Association. And so those are the three petitions that we've received recently. We're reviewing them to make sure they're administratively complete. And then we'll begin sort of a pre-rulemaking process where we'll have some public hearings, we'll take comment, we'll have internal debates within Department of Environmental Conservation and Agency of Natural Resources, and then our secretary will make a determination on whether or not to initiate rulemaking. So rulemaking around reclassification is a long process guided by statute, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to get going on these pre-rulemaking hearings in October and November, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
All right. Oliver Pearson is Lakes and Ponds Manager for the Department of Environmental Conservation. There is an excellent three-part series on this topic in the Caledonian Record from last week. You can also learn more at dec.vermont.gov. Oliver, great having you on the program this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. All the best.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break, and then we'll return to discuss redistricting. And the Sox take on the O's tonight in Baltimore for game two of that series. Need to snap that four-game losing streak. We have coverage beginning at 6:05, first pitch at 7:05 tonight on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. All that counting and data collection from last year's census does have consequences, including how congressional districts might change, and also state house and senate districts. The American Association of Geographers, or AAG, is raising awareness about the redistricting process by bringing together redistricting experts to share their experiences with the general public. Across the country, AAG members are organizing a series of free public panel sessions to give attendees state-specific information about how to get involved in the redistricting process. The Middlebury College Geography Department is working with the AAG to host Vermont's redistricting panel event. That's Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. It's on the Middlebury campus, but you can view it via Zoom. Joining me now to chat about redistricting are two of the panel members. We have Middlebury College political science professor Bert Johnson. Bert, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And we have Chris Gernon, a specialist in geographic information systems, or GIS, and a recent Middlebury College graduate. Chris, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask our guests about redistricting, you can give us a call, 244-1777, or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Chris, what will you be discussing this Friday during the panel discussion?
Yeah, I'm going to be discussing the role of technology in the redistricting process and how advancements in mapping technology has both democratized the redistricting process, but also it's made it easier for those in positions of power to gerrymander and redraw lines to ensure that their own party gets elected.
And then, Bert, what's your area of the presentation that you're going to be responsible for on Friday?
Well, I'll be discussing more of the historical roots of the geographic system of representation in the first place, going all the way back to the beginning of the Republic in the 1780s and 90s.
Now, Chris, why is the American Association of Geographers undertaking this series of panel discussions?
The inspiration for these panel discussions is that historically, geographers have been much more prominently engaged in the redistricting process than they seem to be at the moment. And so the AAG, as a public-facing organization, wants to explore these issues and attempt to bring the public into it and sort of get more involved as geographers in the redistricting process. And they're going to be held in as many states as possible, pretty much like wherever they could find hosts.
Will it be held in every state, or where are they so far?
So far, I think they're in around 20-plus states, but it's pretty much on a state-by-state basis, like who's organizing it in the state and whether or not they could find hosts to organize it.
Well, a tip of the hat to Middlebury College for serving as host for this panel on Friday. Bert, as a political scientist, do you think people have a keen grasp on how districts are created and decided upon?
Probably not. And I think part of the reason for that is that it's done in slightly different ways in different states, so it can be confusing. I think people have an understanding that the process generally takes place every 10 years and it results from population shifts. But beyond that, I think people would really benefit from listening in on a panel like Friday's.
And do you think people have an idea that maybe these districts are created to benefit one party over the other?
I think probably yes. I think people, you know, generally speaking, the public thinks if there's a cynical explanation for something, it's probably correct. So yeah, I think that people understand that may be going on, but maybe not exactly how it happens or the extent to which it happens or any guards against it that there may be.
Now, Chris, you are an expert in geographic information systems, or GIS. Explain what GIS is.
Yeah, a geographic information system is a phone, computer, tablet, or electronic system for capturing, storing, checking, and displaying data. GIS can show many different types of data on one map, such as streets, buildings, vegetation, land cover. And this really enables people to more easily see, analyze, and understand patterns and relationships in geography. And people rely on GIS probably more than they are likely aware. For example, Google Earth or Apple Maps or Google Maps are all examples of a GIS that I'm sure listeners are pretty aware of.
Now, I remember a few years ago, and I think it was a Middlebury College professor who used GIS to take a look at Pickett's Charge, the battle down in Gettysburg during the Civil War. But how is this being utilized to create fairer, more balanced districts, if that's indeed, you know, what they're going to try to create with redistricting?
GIS technologies have really experienced a proliferation in recent years, and it allows people, organizations, companies to gather and process large amounts of data at a pretty fine granularity more efficiently. And so this often means that, like, the Republican and Democratic parties actually know who lives where down to, like, the household level. But the question of using GIS to create fairer or more balanced districts is a pretty hard one. Like, what exactly do we mean by fairer or more balanced districts? Is it a district where it is a competitive race, where everyone's vote can have a big impact on the outcome, which is pretty hard to set up in reality? And then it's like, a lot of the states have constitutional requirements to keep communities of interest whole during the redistricting process. But then we run into the issue of, like, how do you define a community of interest? But regardless, GIS has a huge impact on how districts are created during the redistricting process, and it has basically made redistricting and gerrymandering much more mathematical and precise. Given that parties have access to data at such a fine granularity, they can draw lines that include or exclude people or populations down to the household level. And so that means parties can be very intentional about who they want in a district based on voting history, race, party affiliation, et cetera. And what I've been describing, GIS has been used to help the party's political interest, and that way can really ensure if a party has control of the line drawing process, they can really elect their own party regardless of the population distribution of the state. However, GIS has also really democratized the redistricting process. New tools and websites are coming out that allow anyone with access to the internet to learn how to redistrict and play a part in the redistricting process. Mm. Not too long ago, only those with a lot of funding and large amounts of computing power could create maps and draw lines, but that's quickly changing. And so now there are tools that allow people to draw their own communities of interest and submit it to their legislature, and really be part of the redrawing district process.
Ooh, DIY redistricting. Chris, that sounds kind of fun, actually. Bert, as the country was forming and a state was added, did we redistrict every time that happened? Do we adjust the number of seats in Congress? How did we handle, you know, that as the country was still growing and adding states?
Well, that's really a good question. I do want to second what Chris said about some of these online tools. They're really spectacular and accessible, so I would encourage people to go look at them. But historically, reapportionment happens every 10 years, which means reapportionment should be considered separate from redistricting. Reapportionment means we reallocate the number of House of Representatives seats that every state gets. Gotcha. So that would happen every 10 years after the U.S. Census, as was required by the Constitution. Redistricting, which is redrawing the boundaries of those districts and other districts like state legislative districts, did not happen with regularity every 10 years necessarily. And the reason for that, I think, is political inertia. There was nobody, Supreme Court, forcing states to redistrict with regularity. So legislatures often ignored that. So you had states, for example, that would get an extra seat in Congress, and they would elect, you know, they would elect most representatives by the previous set of districts and then elect the new representative at large in the whole state to avoid the redistricting process entirely. So that led to some kind of amusing situations. But the state legislatures redistricted even less often. In Vermont, for example, for, you know, many, many decades, the lower house of the state legislature had one representative per town.
Right.
And, of course, town populations were changing all the time, but there was no redistricting until the 1960s. And then the Supreme Court stepped in and required it, and that's when things changed in state legislatures all around the country, and we got a much more regular decennial redistricting process.
Chris, do you think geography over politics should be relied upon in creating or reshaping districts?
Yeah, Rick, I think it's pretty hard to make a distinction between geography and politics. How does someone define politics such that it doesn't include geography? Geography has such a huge impact on how people and society exist and interact. The culture and politics of a place or space is so tied to geography and where it is in the country. Like, for example, if there's a big mountain range in the middle of a state, that makes it hard for people on either side of the mountain to interact. And because it has such a big impact on how people interact with each other, their livelihood, et cetera, it also has a big impact on their politics. Now, I'm not trying to say that geography determines your politics, but it certainly has a big impact on who you're around, what you do for a living, et cetera. And in this way, it does have a big impact on politics. I think you can see this pretty clearly with, like, the rural-urban divide across the country or in Vermont. And that's all to say that I think there really is no objectively fair district. It's kind of what we as a society deem is most fair, and thinking about these from different perspectives, such as the geographic, can let us consider what we value as a society and how we want it to shape our politics.
And Bert, you know, in creating these fair districts that Chris talks about, do you think politics and demographics absolutely must be taken into account in redistricting?
Absolutely must. It depends on what you mean by that. I think inevitably, I agree with Chris, that inevitably politics plays a part. So, you know, it's difficult to avoid because it's a political decision about elections, and it's a political process, which ultimately rests in Vermont anyway with the legislature. So it's hard to imagine a situation in which politics wasn't a part of it. But what you can do is you can try to minimize the extent to which each party is able to maximize its advantage. And part of that is making it a transparent process.
Now, Bert, in Vermont, we have two Senate seats, one congressional seat in Washington. So what does it matter for us when it comes to redistricting?
Well, I think in Vermont, what it matters is because the redistricting will take account of population shifts over the last 10 years. And those population shifts have been largely towards the northwest part of the state. So those areas are going to get more representation, places in Chittenden, Franklin, Lamoille, and other parts of the state are going to get relatively less. So that this process will reflect these population shifts that have taken place.
And then how is redistricting done here in Vermont?
Well, the first step, which is what we're doing now, is that there is a Vermont Legislative Apportionment Board, which is a tripartisan board of seven members that are appointed by the governor and party leaders that produce a draft map. They'll be doing that this fall, and then they forward that map to the legislature, which then ultimately makes the decision. And, you know, in considering a draft map, it has to take account of some various things under the Constitution and the law, such as things like contiguity, that is the extent to which each district represents a regular geographic shape, and compactness, and preserving political subdivisions, as I believe Chris was talking about. And so they'll do that, and they'll forward it to the legislature. Now, the legislature doesn't always have to agree with what they do. And in fact, 10 years ago, they basically didn't. The Legislative Apportionment Board sent a plan to the legislature that dramatically reduced the number of House districts represented by two members, for example, and actually eliminated the Chittenden County six-member Senate district. And the legislature decided against both of those things. So the legislature could do what it wants, but that's the process.
And Tom Little, who is the chair of the Vermont Legislative Apportionment Board, will be on the panel that both Chris and Bert are going to be on at Middlebury this Friday at 3 o'clock. And listeners, you can participate using Zoom. Chris, Bert touched upon this from 2010 to 2020. What are the biggest changes that have occurred in Vermont that interest you?
Yeah, I think Bert may be able to speak to this a little better than me, but I think areas in the Northwest generally increased, like areas around Stowe, Burlington, St. Albans, and Hartford, while areas in the South, such as like Springfield, Rutland, Bennington, and St. Johnsbury, decreased. I will say that Marlboro and Dover are exceptions, and those experienced increases in population. But yeah, generally just this means that areas in the Northwest will gain more representation in the House, while areas in the south of the state will likely lose some representation.
Bert, politically, will that be any kind of a shift or change what we see in the state House going forward?
I do think it'll be a shift. I think it'll be a shift towards more representatives coming from the Northwest, as Chris is saying. I think, but I do think that kind of a shift has been taking place for several decades. Mm-hmm. I think what we may finally see this year is the elimination of that six-member Chittenden Senate district that I mentioned before. The legislature in 2019 voted to end the six-member Senate district in this round, so they may actually accept a Legislative Apportionment Board proposal that would do that. And I think what that means is that what's interesting to me is that while overall representation is moving towards those northwest areas, Chittenden, Franklin, and Loyal. What may happen within Chittenden is that Burlington itself, at least as respects to the Senate district, may lose a little bit of power because some of those senators may be elected from districts that are in outlying areas of Chittenden County. So, you know, Hinesburg, Colchester, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see, you know, a redistribution statewide to the Northwest, but then within that Northwestern area, a little bit of an evening out.
Chris, you mentioned some online tools that people can use to kind of do redistricting at home. What are some of those tools?
Yeah, Districtor is a big one that I'm familiar with. But I think it's pretty easy for people to just go online and Google redistricting tools, mm-hmm. and a list of them should come up. And luckily, the people who have designed these tools make them very user friendly, and they a lot of them have user guides. To make the barrier of entry into learning these programs really, really easy. And a lot of these tools actually have the ability for you to draw your own community of interest and send it directly to email it to a legislature. And so I really recommend people try this out. I think it's hard to stay plugged into politics 24/7. I think if there ever is a time for people to be plugged into what's going on in their state, I think during redistricting is the time. So at least try to stay in at least once every 10 years, and they can have a big impact on what happens politically in their own state.
Chris Kernan is a specialist in Geographic Information Systems, or GIS, and is a recent graduate of Middlebury College. Bert Johnson is a Middlebury College political science professor, and you can learn more about Friday's event and how to register. Go to aag.org/redistricting. Bert, Chris, thanks so much for being on with us this morning.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for the CBS News update, then we'll return to learn about what school's like when it's held in a Burlington mall. And don't forget, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, full hour of the Fall Migration Bird Show. Today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, it's the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, and then we've got 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Yesterday on the show, we heard from the chair and vice chair of the Harwood Unified Union School District. They're putting a $60 million bond issue in front of voters in November for renovations to their high school building, originally constructed in the mid-1960s, and an expansion to Crossett Brook Middle School. Burlington's going to have to find an answer to its high school building problems, and the school district didn't have the luxury of developing a plan and are now holding classes in the old Macy's department store. Joining us now to talk about the situation and what she learned about the challenges Burlington High School's teachers and students are facing is VT Digger's Grace Benninghoff. Grace, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Grace about what she observed at BHS at the mall, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Grace, I want to make sure, did you attend high school in a shopping mall, an arcade, a sports arena, a warehouse, or an actual school building?
I attended high school in an actual school building.
I was afraid you were going to say I was homeschooled, and I didn't even cover for that. All right. So what did you think when you first heard that Burlington High School was in a Macy's department store?
I think my original reaction was probably similar to most people's. I kind of wondered how that might work. I think my initial vision of what it might look like was, you know, empty clothing racks and just one big open space. And it was hard for me to imagine where classrooms might fit. So I think my first reaction was just sort of wondering how that even could function as a school.
Now, I got my vaccination for COVID at the old J.C. Penney's here in Berlin. What were your first impressions when you actually visited the Burlington High School in the Macy's department store?
You know, actually visiting the school, I was pleasantly surprised for sure. It was, you know, it was very clean. There were walls erected to form classrooms. There was a gym. There was a cafeteria that was sort of in a something that was looked like an expanded hallway. So it looked a lot more similar to a traditional high school than I expected. But I think the thing that surprised me the most, that seemed like it would be a real challenge, was just that the walls most of the time weren't reaching the ceiling. And there was just a really big noise issue. The other thing I noticed really quickly was that there didn't seem to be a large area for students to congregate, just students away from teachers, where they could kind of hang out or chat or mess around. Because that, for me, was a really big part of my high school experience, was, you know, congregating in a cafeteria where teachers went around, or, you know, out in like a grassy field. And that wasn't something that seems to be present at the Macy's location for Burlington High School.
But Grace, a mall is all about hanging out, conversing. It was rarely about actually shopping. But I guess the mall part is all gone, right? It's just the Macy's department store that's left in the location.
Right. So inside the school, there are definitely relics of the Macy's department store. You know, there are big posters of Levi jeans. There's red carpeting still. Their cafeteria is called the Michael Kors Cafe because they've left the Michael Kors sign up. The escalators are still there. So there are a lot of things that give away that this used to be a Macy's. But of course, the way it functions is nothing really like it used to as a mall.
And there's no clerks to help you, you know, to find a pair of jeans or, you know, a dress if you're looking for something there.
No, no customer service like that.
Ugh, bummer. All right. So let's go back to how this move all came about. How quickly, what happened that caused the sudden change of venue for Burlington High School?
So back in September of 2020, so a little over a year ago now, Burlington High School was getting ready to come back to school. So it was obviously amid the COVID pandemic, and teachers had prepared to enter into sort of a hybrid model of teaching in which students would be in the classroom a few days a week and from home doing remote learning the rest of the days. So basically, at the same time as the school was coming back in person and online, they were conducting some air quality testing to make sure that the ventilation was good enough to have students back in the building, and also to prepare for a renovation to the high school, because the high school was a really old building. It was built in the 1960s, and for a long time, teachers, students, parents, and community members had been calling for renovations and updates to the building. So what happened is, on the first day of school, which luckily was a remote day, the principal and superintendent received a call from the people who had been conducting the air quality testing, letting them know that they had discovered toxic levels of PCBs in the air. And PCBs are a chemical found in some old building materials. So it's a little bit like lead paint or things like that, where it's just something we used to use in buildings. We discovered it maybe wasn't that safe, so we stopped using it. But a lot of old buildings still have those materials in them. And unfortunately, in the case of Burlington High School, PCBs had been used in the window caulkings, but those chemicals had moved into the air. So basically, the administration was alerted that it wasn't safe anymore for students, teachers, faculty to be in the building, and that they would need to evacuate immediately.
Mm. Was there any other place that was considered as a temporary location for the school other than Macy's?
you know, I think that they looked, you know, I don't know how seriously other places were considered. When I spoke with the superintendent, Tom Flanagan, he said that Macy's was really the only place that met the criteria they were looking for, which was they needed a big enough space to hold their entire student body, faculty, staff, teachers. They also needed a place that was sort of a blank slate where they could build walls and sort of erect classrooms. And I think, you know, maybe they considered some other locations. There was some talk of maybe somehow combining with the Edmonds campus, but I don't think that, you know, it was my impression that Macy's was the only place they really seriously considered because it was just the only place that met their criteria.
And give us an idea of that space. Is it a couple floors? Is it one floor with a very high ceiling? What is the general layout of the Macy's building?
Yeah, so it is, it's two stories, and the stories are connected by, you know, escalators, just like any other department store. But of course, there also are, you know, stairs for fire and emergency situations. But the building looks, it looks very clean. It's a fairly big space for a department store, but I have to say that for a school, it can feel a little small. And yeah, it's two stories. One side of the bottom story connects to a parking garage, just like malls, big department stores and malls often do. There aren't any windows, obviously, inside of the space, so each classroom is windowless because, you know, a classroom will be in what used to be, you know, the clothing department or whatever. So the only windows are on the, you know, exterior of the building. But there's a lot of really bright, like, fluorescent lights. It's a pretty standard sort of two-story building.
No windows. What would I look at during class? Oh, I guess the teacher and the blackboard. All right. So you did a piece for the Deeper Dig for VT Digger. Who did you speak with for that piece?
I spoke with a lot of people. So included in the podcast, I spoke with four students, a teacher, the principal, the superintendent, and I believe that was everyone I included. I also spoke with an assistant principal there, and the public relations person at the high school gave me a tour, and I spoke with him as well.
Now, the staff and students have been remote for some of the past year. Did that affect their acceptance one way or another about attending school at the Macy's?
Yeah, I think that the staff and students were really eager to get back to school in person. Understandably, they thought they were going to come back and get to be at least partly in person starting in September of 2020. But when their building ended up being uninhabitable, they had to go back to completely remote for 6 months longer than they originally thought they would need to. So by the time that they found out they were going to be attending school in the Macy's, I think it seems like most people's reaction was just excitement at least getting back to some version of in-person schooling after, you know, a full year of completely remote learning.
Grace, is it easy for students to just forget that they're in a department store and possibly in the junior section and believe that they are in a unique high school setting?
You know, I think that while I wouldn't say students can forget they're in a department store, particularly because of the escalators, because of a lot of the signs and jewelry display cases that have been left up there, I do think that, you know, the classrooms and some of the spaces have been really, really, you know, nicely done and can at least allow students the experience of some kind of in-person learning that is hopefully more engaging than remote learning was.
Now, in high school, we did a lot of, I'll say, silly things. And having an escalator in our high school would have been, it would have been quite dangerous. So is there anyone that monitors the use of those escalators?
No, I don't think there's a specific person who's monitoring the use of the escalators, but they are in a pretty central they're kind of right in the center of the school. So the cafeteria, there's sort of a student like support center right at the bottom of the escalators. And I think that because it's in such a central area and there's usually teachers or administrators around, that might deter, you know, students from messing around too much on the escalators, at least from what I saw.
Mm-hmm. And I would prefer if from now on you do refer to the cafeteria by its full name, the Michael Kors Cafeteria, as you mentioned
earlier.
Oh,
my gosh, of course.
Yes, please.
Yes, excuse me. The Michael Kors Cafe.
Cafe, yeah. Product placement is everything in going to school at a Macy's. Now, what kind of work had to be done to make this space school ready?
So, yeah, I don't know all of the particulars of this. They had a team of architects who they worked with who were able to get the Macy's all fitted up for, you know, the school to move in within about 3 months, which is pretty, impressive. So from what the principal told me, you know, they toured the school before any of the renovations were done, and it was really just how Macy's had left it. So, you know, there were just abandoned clothing racks. It was just fully an abandoned Macy's building, which, you know, I think you can imagine how that might look. And so architects came in, you know, I think they cleaned it up. They removed stuff that was non-essential, and, you know, made the decision to leave some of these things like jewelry display cases and, Levi posters on the wall and stuff, both, I think, because it was easier to leave it, and also because it's just, yeah, it's not really impeding the function of the school to have it there. So they, you know, erected these white walls that don't quite reach the ceiling because there needs to be ventilation. And as I mentioned before, there are no windows. They sort of built like a central office that, you know, like when you walk into the school, you sign in there, and that is where the dressing rooms used to be. So some of the old dressing rooms are used as closet space right now. And I hear that they may eventually be used as, you know, rooms to take like a private phone call for administrators and staff. But yeah, I think it was just a lot of work. And also, I think something that really went into it was considering airflow and how in a building without, you know, with only windows on the exterior walls, how proper ventilation could be maintained.
I think the building would have been an excellent high life Fronton. And I guess it is lucky for the district that this building was spared, compared to everything else that was torn down already, for, City Place. I think Dave Farrington Construction did the work, of making it school ready. And he's one of the partners, as City Place moves forward. How has the move affected school spirit at BHS Macy's campus?
You know, what I heard from students is actually that it has brought about sort of a resurgence of school spirit for the school. So during remote school, I think that a lot of students sort of lost interest in school spirit. Also, you know, kids weren't all together in one place. Sports games weren't happening. Plays weren't happening. So the chance to all be together again, I think, has really facilitated that. But also, just going through such a unique and sort of, like funny experience together has, has brought about some really, unique, ways of expressing school spirit. So they've kind of adopted an unofficial mascot in the mall rat. So there have been some students and some teachers who've made mall rat sweatshirts and t-shirts. And, you know, one of the students told me that at a soccer game, they were all cheering, you know, like, go ball rats. So I think that it's actually been a really good thing for school spirit and has maybe, sort of reignited some kinship and sense of community among the student body.
Ah, that's pure gold, the BHS Mall Rats. Now, imagine going off to college. It is a great story to tell, although I think everyone would assume you're lying. No, really, I did go to a high school that was in a Macy's, a downtown Macy's. You've mentioned right. There's no windows. We've talked about the cafe. Is there any kind of a gymnasium? There's obviously no sports fields around.
Yeah, there's kind of a little So they're still using the sports fields at the old high school because they're, you know, mostly outdoors. And so they still use the fields back at the original Burlington High School for soccer practice, for football games, stuff like that, which is obviously a drive away from the Macy's campus. But in the Macy's, there is sort of a small gymnasium that it's not, like, big enough to play basketball or to have, like, a ton of activities take place, but I think that it sounds like it's been used for things like yoga and sometimes dodgeball. So, you know, more regular, limited PE type activities rather than real athletic events.
All right. And I'm sure the high school kids had staked out the campus pretty quickly to find out, are there places to sneak a smoke or a vape or to cut classes there, Grace?
I mean, you know, I'm sure that students can figure that out wherever they are if they really want to. But I think that, you know, something that was actually emphasized to me by the school is that there are a lot fewer entrances and exits to this building than the location up in North Burlington where the high school used to be. So it's a little harder for students to, you know, casually slip out of the building or come in late because I think there are just a handful of entrances and exits, whereas in the old high school there were, you know, multiple buildings, there were entrances and exits all over, so it was a little bit simpler. Now it's a little bit more like there's just a front door, there's a side door, and most of those doors are monitored, so it's more challenging. I would imagine.
On the positive side, does that make security easier, which is unfortunately something we have to worry about in our schools today?
Yeah, that was emphasized to me as well, that security is tighter at this location because, you know, something about the old campus is there were multiple buildings. So sometimes, you know, a student would have class in one building and then be going into another building, and it might just be easier to have, you know, doors propped open because that way students could move more freely between buildings. But here, everything's more centralized. Everything's really in this one space. So, you know, the doors are locked when, like, students aren't, you know, when it's not dismissal or arrival. And there are just really a small handful of entrances. So I think security is a lot tighter at this campus.
What was the overall feeling of the students you spoke with about this setup and going to school at Macy's?
You know, I think that first and foremost, students were really grateful to be back in person. But on the other hand, even though this is better than being remote from what they all said, I think it still feels like there's something sort of lost. You know, it doesn't feel like a traditional high school. I think it is really tough for students to focus sometimes with some of the noise issues that are happening in the school. You know, kids were telling me stories about discussing Frankenstein in their English class and then having the band start playing in the room over and, you know, not being able to hear because there's no wall separating those spaces. Mm. So I think that there have been some challenges in terms of, you know, ability to focus and, feeling like as comfortable in this space as they did in their old school. And part of that too is that there aren't a lot of spaces for students to socialize. I spoke with a few students who kind of remembered these benches where they used to go sit in their old school, and they could just sit there with their friends and kind of hang out and mess around, you know, before school or after school, and they could all sort of convene there. And at the Macy's, there isn't really a place like that for students to just kind of meet up and know that their friends will be there. And, you know, they can all meet up and go somewhere after school together. It's a little bit more, it's a little bit more, I guess, built out. And there isn't just sort of that random space for students to be. So I think while students feel really excited to be back in person and to be back with their community, there still is a sense of loss, and I think that kids are still facing a lot of a lot of obstacles there to, you know, having the best learning environment that they could.
Yeah. Props to the school, to the staff and the students for making the most of the situation. Grace Benninghoff writes for VT Digger. You can find her podcast and story. It's called Life and Learning Inside the Burlington Macy's at vtdigger.org. Grace, thank you so much for sharing your observations this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update from them, and then we'll be back to hear about the upcoming Vermont Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. What do you do when reading or watching Tales of the Future or a fantasy are just not enough? When you want to live it for a while or dress up in character? How can you be transported to a world where the Death Star or the Enterprise exists? Or where you get to pick the brains of authors who have sent you into the worlds of forbidden magic and dark arts? Well, the same folks who have given you the opportunity to strut about in the Middle Ages and cop a British accent at Renaissance fairs are also the people who allow you to do what I just described. And here to talk about all of that is Jeff Fulb. He's the owner and general manager of Vermont Gatherings. Jeff, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Morning. Good to be here.
And Vermont Gatherings puts on the Vermont Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo that's happening this weekend. We're going to talk about that. Listeners, to ask Jeff about any of the events that Vermont Gatherings puts on, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay, Jeff, remind us again what Vermont Gatherings is.
So we produce a number, an ever-growing number, of uniquely Vermont genre and family-friendly events. So we've got the Summer Renaissance Fair, which we talked about had back in June.
Yep.
We've got a Winter Renaissance Fair, which is kind of the same thing scaled down and indoors, which is coming up in February of 2022. I believe that'll be the fourth year of that. We've got the Vermont Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo, which is coming up this weekend at the fairgrounds. And then we've got a whole bunch of other really kind of unique events. We've got a steampunk expo for anybody who's into steampunk. We've got some masquerade balls coming up. We've got a really neat event coming up in November, our first time, the Armored Combat Sports Northeast Championship. If anybody's ever seen Night Fights on the History Channel, or basically it's MMA fighting in full armor with weapons. It is a – it's like watching a car race and all they do is crash.
Wow. And that's what a lot of people watch for. How did you get started in all of this?
As a kid, I was always a fan of sci-fi. I think my mom was. I watched a lot of original Star Trek with her. I remember, if not the original series, at least the first rerunning of it. Read a lot of science fiction, got involved in – the role-playing aspect in the movies young, and then probably right after college, it's been almost 30 years now, got involved with the Renaissance fairs and some of the conventions and expos, and kind of went from being a patron to getting involved as a vendor or something else. And then now we moved back to Vermont, my wife and I, a few years ago, realized there really wasn't any of these shows here. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people didn't necessarily want to go to Boston or New York for it, so we decided to see if there was a market here, and obviously there was.
In a normal year, how many of these events do you put on, and where are you right now because of the pandemic?
Between today, so including Sci-Fi Fantasy this weekend, through the end of next year, we currently have 11 events scheduled, and when we get done, that'll probably end up being 13 or 14. That'll be our next 2022 will be our biggest year ever. 2020 was going to be. We got one show in. We got the Winter Renaissance Fair in February and then thought we were going to be closed down for 2 weeks. and didn't get reopened again until this past June with the Summer Renaissance Fair, which ended up being our biggest event ever. I think people were just ready to get out and socialize and stay local and do something with the family.
All right. And did you think maybe in 5 years or so when we can laugh about this, you'll have a 2020 pandemic expo?
Oh, boy. Or either that or we'll just forget 2020 existed, you know, to rip that page out of the calendar maybe.
All right. I'm not going to be planning events for you anytime soon. All right. Let's move to the present or maybe the future. Tell us what you've got planned for this weekend.
So the Sci-Fi Fantasy Expo is a great event. Instead of focusing on certain mediums like comic books, we really focus on the genres. So science fiction and fantasy. So we've got authors, artists, comic book designers, game designers, podcasters, Vermont TV and video producers, vendors, fan organizations, prop makers. I mean, I can go on and on. It's really focused on the creative individuals and groups within Vermont and northern New England who work in the genre of sci-fi and fantasy. So whether it's the 501st, which is the big international Star Wars cosplay and costuming group, mm-hmm. or whether it's a local artist, or I'm really kind of excited. We've got a couple of I'll call them movie, TV, video producers who have locally done some sci-fi fantasy films and programs that they're going to be screening at our show. Mm. We've got a movie accurate Ecto-1 from Ghostbusters coming, and the 802 Ghostbusters cosplay group to kind of play with it. We've got a whole authors and artists section. And then we got the interactive part, and that's what I'm really excited about, is the panels and workshops and demos. One of our goals, besides promoting and supporting the artisans and crafters and local community that way, is to try and introduce and explain to people, to our patrons, what they can do. You know, they can write a novel, they can build a costume, they can start a podcast. So we've got a lot of how-to panels and workshops going on, with the hope that maybe they'll go from being a patron 1 year to a participant the next year, that maybe they'll go home in between and give it a try, something that they wouldn't have done on their own. But now that they've, you know, talked to these people and been to the workshops and, hey, I can try writing a novel, or I can get into cosplay and get involved. And that's really building that community that we know and love. I mean, I'm a geek. I'm a nerd. You know, more people coming to the fairs and the expos and dressing up and getting involved, even outside of the events, you know, of getting together and socializing with groups, of just being able to express themselves. I know personally with certain members of my family, you know, I'm somewhat outgoing, definitely considered an extrovert. Not everyone is. There's a lot of people that are very quiet and shy, but you get them to these events and you get them in costume and you get them with people they know are like-minded, and people really come out of their shell, and that's great to see.
Now, one thing I'm always worried about when I hear about this sci-fi and fantasy expo is how they can peacefully coexist. I mean, if you've got a stormtrooper and you've got a fairy over here, sci-fi versus fantasy, anything, you know, are they going to play nicely together?
Most of them do. The two places you got to watch out for are stormtroopers in red shirts and pirates and ninjas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, pirates and ninjas do not get along. We tried to do a panel with the two of them, and it just, yeah, was ugly.
And red shirts are from Star Trek, right?
Yes.
Are they the people who usually wind up dying? Are they?
Well, one group can't hit anything, and one group always gets hit. So it's
– All right. Let's see. So no spells versus phasers happening in the parking lot during this then?
Not scheduled.
Not scheduled. Okay. But if that's something you're into, you just might see it during the sci-fi and fantasy expo going on this weekend. Are you personally more sci-fi or are you more fantasy?
It depends on the day and the week. I mean, I know with my reading habits and how my gaming habits or anything else, it really depends. I can bounce back and forth. It depends on what's on TV, what book catches my eye. I really have grown up with a deep interest in both. So, you know, whether it's the Wheel of Time show that's coming out, or hopefully the reboot of Babylon 5, you know, that are all in the news now, I'm eager for both.
And I hate to ask you this question because it might really sour half your sci-fi fans, but are you more Star Trek or are you more Star Wars?
I'll be political and not answer that question, yeah. But I will say I'm old school on both. I mean, I was, like I said, I watched Star Trek, I think, on literally the first reshowing of it. I'm not quite that old. And I was in the movie theater in, what, 77 when the first Star Trek – or Star Wars came out. I'm a fan of both.
Yeah, before all the prequels, et cetera. So, okay, fair enough. You really tightrope that one quite nicely, Jeff.
Thank you.
Now, you've touched on some of these groups in your, you know, as you kind of introduced the overview, but I want to dig down and get to know more of what's going on. You have some very interesting groups that'll be there, and one is what's this Ghostbusters Ecto One you talked about?
We're friends with a group, a family actually, out of New York, who build and show replica vehicles from different movies and TV shows. So at our first Sci-Fi Fantasy Expo, they brought a DeLorean from Back to the Future, along with all the props from the movie. And to give an example of how accurate these guys' work is, they just finished filming a TV episode with the cast, with Marty and the Doc in their car and their props for a TV show. So they just finished putting together and building a movie accurate Ecto-1 from the original Ghostbusters, and they've got a whole bunch of the props. So that'll be there for people to see and take pictures with. And then kind of working with them, we've got the 802 Ghostbusters, which is the local Ghostbuster cosplay group. So they'll be there. Maybe it'll be a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Maybe there won't. But it'd be one of many kind of interactive groups. Like I mentioned, the 501st, if you're into Star Wars, the Guardian Legion, the superheroes will be there. One thing about these events, whether it's the Renaissance Fair or the Sci-Fi Fantasy Expo, you're always welcome to come in costume. It is not required.
Mm-hmm.
And all we ask is that it be tasteful and safe.
Gotcha.
So if you want to come and, you know, cosplay and be a superhero, you're welcome to. If you want to come in your regular street clothes and meet and see one, that's great too.
All right, so life-size Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, probably not a good idea.
Yeah, that could... maybe not quite life, maybe scaled.
Right. You also have a group called Haunted Sleigh Ride, and that's S-L-A-Y. Help me out on that one.
So that event, which is going on up in Grand Isle, was originally started by us in 2019, along with some friends of ours on a farm up in Grand Isle. And it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, Sleigh Ride, S-L-A-Y.
Right.
We put on a two-weekend, four-day haunted sleigh ride out in the fields of their farm. And barring the weather that year, which actually flooded us out the day before, and we had to rebuild the entire thing in about 24 hours, it went great. We had tons of people. They had a blast. We had, I think, three wagons going and all kinds of frights and scares out in the fields. And this year, because of our scheduling, because of COVID and rescheduling some of our events, Sci-Fi Fantasy is normally in April, and it will be again next year. Because we're doing it in October, we weren't able to be involved in the sleigh ride. So our partners in at the farm will be taking care of it. So please go.
Yeah,
go on
wild.
Facebook. The Haunted Sleigh Ride is a blast. Get your tickets. It's just that right level and mix of scary and fun.
Good.
So you're screaming and laughing at the same time.
Okay. You may never ride a sleigh again. All right. Now, a lot of gaming involved here and game groups. I'm going to ask you about, first of all, Carnage.
So Carnage is a great event that goes on in Vermont. They've been going, they've been around a lot longer than we have actually. And they are a gaming convention, a gaming show. It's a long weekend of tabletop and role playing and collectible card games. I believe they moved recently. They're down at Mount Snow, I believe. And that's coming up in about a month or so.
Okay.
And basically they're going to be at our event, you know, promoting their event. As I said, one of the things we really like to do is support, you know, the other kind of creative artisans and events going on in Vermont. As long as you're not the same weekend as us, you know, you're not our competition. And being a gamer myself, if I can help support them, I will. So they'll be there demoing and talking about their event.
Now, there's something called Conflict 47. It's going on all day during both days. So is this one of those games that takes forever to play, or is the game set up for people to try out whenever?
Yes. obviously, if we were sitting there playing and had nothing else to do, I'm sure we could play it all day. However, because we're going to have people coming in and out and wanting to try it, this is going to be more of a demo day so people can get involved, step in, play for a little while, watch for a little while, learn the game, and then go off and do all the other fun stuff available.
Which include authors and artists. I want to talk about a few. Andrew Liptak has a history of cosplay coming out.
Yes, he does.
That's exciting.
Andrew and I are pretty good friends. He's also involved with the 501st.
Yeah.
He's going to be there. He's bringing some other authors with him. A great person to talk to when you're at a costuming event, because he really kind of is writing that definitive book on – just all kinds of cosplay, costuming, whether it's the 501st or anime, superheroes, just, you know, why we do it, how we do it. I'm not a big cosplayer. I'll be perfectly honest. My wife is. Mm. But I love interacting with them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to walk around and have, you know, the red shirts, the pirates, the fairies, Darth Vader, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, all around, just really make it a fun and interesting event and time, and to interact with them is even better.
All right. Another one of my favorites is Robert Waldo Brunell Jr. He's the creator of the hilarious Mr. Brunell Explains It All. He'll be there.
He
and
will
that
be there.
Should be a riot just chatting with him.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? What other authors, artists of note that you have coming?
So James McDonald. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with him. James McDonald and his wife Deborah Doyle. They wrote multiple series of sci-fi fantasy novels over the last couple of decades. Big fans. My wife and I. We actually originally met him because on the side he's a magician, and he actually is the wandering magician at our Renaissance Fair. And met him and said, "Your name sounds familiar." And he's like, "Well, I also wrote some books." And we kind of went and looked in our bookshelf and went, "Can you sign these?"
Oh, my gosh.
So he'll be there. We'll have readings and a couple of panels that a couple of the authors are working on, how to get published. I mean, because I think a lot of people have kind of written something and kind of stuck it on a shelf.
Yep.
So let's help them try and get something published. Something as simple as how to create a character. We'll have panels and workshops on that. And we've also set up a little area for when they're not paneling and doing workshops for a bunch of authors to kind of sit around and talk. You can sit down with them. You pick their brain, you know, interact and really get to know people. It's not walk up to the table, get an autograph, walk away. We really want to get people, you know, interacting, whether it's Robert or one of the artists will be sketching. I know you can get artwork literally made right at the expo, mm-hmm. whether it's talking with an author on how to create a world or a character. We're going to have workshops on how to do costuming. We're going to have some really kind of out there squatching 101, hunting for Sasquatch.
Ah.
Yep, for those you know, kind of paranormal Bigfoot fans. We've got some –
This is your place, folks.
Oh, yeah. You know, we've got some charity groups that are joining us. UVM Children's Hospital has actually gotten involved in some gaming to help promote and support the Children's Hospital. They'll be there. Gamers for a Cure. Always great group. We work with them in all of our events. Can't say it enough. Great family event. Bring the grandkids, bring the grandparents. And yeah, you talked about Star Wars versus Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at something like Star Wars, you know, I'm in my 50s. I remember the original movie in the theater. And yet for the younger generations, it's still coming out on TV and movies today. And we're looking forward to the, you know, new series coming out next year. So whether you're, you know, in high school or you know, retiring, we all kind of have that in common.
Well, you also have vendors that people will encounter there. One that I found interesting is called Just Ducked It, that does duct tape art.
Oh, my God.
Incredible.
She does incredible work. I was floored the first time I saw it, and she's only gotten, you know, better and expanded what she does since. Yes, using duct tape, she creates portraits and pictures, whether it's a dragon or Mr. Spock or whatever. You seeing these, you can't believe that that's the medium she's using.
Mm. All right. And you mentioned them a little bit earlier, but Armored Combat Championships, when's that coming up?
Second weekend of November. I believe it's the 13th. at the fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. Tickets are on sale online. Actually, tickets for all of our events you can find either on our website, which is vtgatherings.com, or on Facebook. You can look us up on Facebook under Vermont Gatherings or under the events. So you can look up the Vermont Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo, Armor Combat Sports. We can get tickets online, more information online. For the Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo, tickets are available at the door both days. Again, you can come in costume. You don't have to. Bring the whole family. Expect to have a lot of fun.
And Winter Renaissance Fair, about when is that?
First weekend of February, I believe 5th and 6th, also indoors at the fairgrounds. Already starting to put that together and book people for that. Yeah, that's always a fun event. That's that, you know, I don't want to wait till next year's Renaissance Fair, so you kind of get that taste midwinter. Plus, you know, what else are you going to do?
Good point. Jeff Fulb is the owner and general manager of Vermont Gatherings. To learn more about this weekend's Vermont Sci-Fi and Fantasy Expo, you can go to VTSF Expo, VTSFExpo.com. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us again this morning.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivigan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah up next. And tomorrow morning, 9 to 10, it's the Fall Migration Bird Show for the full hour. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.